Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has devoted his work to better understanding and working against crimes against children. David Finkelhor is the director of the Crimes Against Children Research Center and co-director of the Family Research Laboratory at the University of New Hampshire, where he is a professor of sociology. Dr. Finkelhor has been studying child victimization, child maltreatment, and family violence since 1977, and his work on child sexual abuse has been nationally recognized, most recently receiving the National Scientific Impact Award for the prevention and treatment of child abuse and neglect. He'll be a guest of OU Tulsa this Thursday, speaking on myths and realities about internet crimes against children. He says our perception about online predators is somewhat misplaced. The idea of a predator attracting a child and forcibly sexually assaulting or molesting the youth is largely inaccurate. A more realistic model is of an adult or older adolescent seducing a youth into a statutory sex crime. He'll be discussing his work and an alternative set of prevention messages that might be more effective in his talk Thursday evening at 6 p.m. at the Schusterman Learning Center at OU Tulsa. Dr. David Finkelhor is my guest today. David Finkelhor, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You're going to be speaking on the myths and realities about internet crimes against children. And I think that myth, as you refer to it, is sort of the accepted wisdom of what is going on, that there are strangers out there on the internet praying, trying to ingratiate themselves with your kids on the internet. And you've found that that's not necessarily the case.
Well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. Yeah. There are indeed predators out there. There are kids who are getting into exploitative sexual relationships with people online. But the dynamics are somewhat different from, I think, what many people have imagined. It's not primarily these older adults who are pretending to be kids and luring their prey into meeting them, at which time they kind of abduct them and forcibly sexually assault them. The dynamics are much more akin to what we think of as statutory sex crimes, where an adult starts a conversation with vulnerable youth and offers kind of affection and attention and interest and support, oftentimes presents themselves as an adult. But this youth eventually comes to feel like this is somebody that they really like, who they can trust, who they may even feel some romantic or affectionate feelings for. And this person proposes they get together. Usually they understand that it's for sexual and romantic purposes, but they go out to meet them because they see it as an adventure. They see this as someone who's going to teach them something. There's some groups that are particularly vulnerable, like kids who have poor relationships with their families or their peers, kids who are dealing with sexual orientation issues and are looking for someone to help them understand what it means to be gay. So warning kids about, you know, don't talk to strangers. People can mislead you about how old they are. These are probably not the effective prevention messages that we need. What we need to be doing, this is much more complicated, is talking to teenagers about why they shouldn't be having sexual relationships with considerably older persons, why these relationships don't work out, why there's generally an exploitative motive here. And it isn't really true love.
Well, how hard is that to convey that message of exploitive actions as opposed to this idea of true love, which does appeal to people of all ages, but especially teenagers?
Yes, but I think we have to think sort of the way teenagers might be thinking about this. So one avenue that I think we should be talking about more is, you know, not how humiliated and embarrassed you were going to be, but posing the question, how would you feel if this person went to jail because of you, because of the relationship you had? You know, there's something that I think maybe they haven't thought about. The other thing that I think we could be doing more of is mobilizing the bystanders in these situations. It turns out that, you know, young people talk to their friends about what's going on, and frequently their buddies know that this person, their friend is having a conversation or a flirtation with somebody online who's considerably older, but they don't feel empowered to say anything or do anything about it.
Well, oftentimes
empowered to weigh in and say, you know, I don't think this is a good idea. And maybe even I'm going to have to tell someone about it.
And peer approval oftentimes leads to people not saying anything at all. The idea of, you know, talking about something like this that would perhaps get peer disapproval, the fear of peer disapproval.
Well, peers play a very big role in the lives of young people. So, yeah, I mean, trying to change the norms in the peer group can be really important for all kinds of prevention efforts. And what we're finding is that actually oftentimes young people aren't clear about what the peer norms are. I mean, a lot of peers, for example, disapprove of bullying behavior, but they, you know, are reluctant to say anything. They don't want to incur the wrath of somebody else, or they don't want to appear to be sitting in judgment. But, you know, kind of explaining to them how important that might be, how it helps improve the atmosphere for everybody in the school or the class or the organization, those kinds of things can give them courage to do it.
Well, what is the most important things we need to know about internet crimes against children, in your view?
Well, this is going to sound paradoxical and maybe shocking to some people, but I think we need to not overestimate its frequency. Because the internet is new, because it's changing a lot of our social relationships, and also because it's revealed certain things that we didn't see quite so explicitly before, but that was, I think, always there. The internet has generated a considerable amount of anxiety, and there's a story out there that the internet is what I call a deviance amplifying technology, that it's putting kids in a lot of danger and making them more delinquent and risk-taking and corrupting them in various ways. And what's interesting is that almost all the social indicators that we have about how teenagers are doing these days, and also about the internet as well, suggest that actually risk-taking has been declining, that safety has been improving, and that the portion of problem behavior that occurs online is a small portion of the kinds of problems that kids are encountering. So the vast majority of the sexual abuse and sexual assault and sex crime they experience is in the face-to-face environment. The vast majority of the bullying they encounter still is in the face-to-face environment. And I am not in favor of having a lot of specialized internet safety and internet prevention programs. I think that what we need to be doing is targeting or including internet prevention ideas in curricula and the messages that we are already giving kids about how to prevent bullying, about how to stay safe from sexual assault, about how to improve the quality of their general safety, and not rely on special internet programs.
Well, how do you explain the sort of the perception that this is happening all over the internet, if you will? Is it basically sensationalized media coverage of the events that do occur?
I wouldn't say sensationalized media coverage. I think it's been good that the media has been covering some of the things that happen online so that people are aware of them. But you know, because it's new, it's gotten a little bit of priority attention. But the internet has done something else that I don't think we've been fully aware of, which is that it's made things that we didn't see or we weren't aware of so explicitly much clearer than it was before. So there were always adults who were trying to get sexual with teenagers, for example. But it wasn't down there in black and white in the chat logs and the, you know, on the social media sites. Now it is. People see it, and it's a lot easier to kind of feel the, you know, the malevolence of it in some sense. Bullying happened a lot, but it wasn't kind of down there in black and white. Now it is, once again, on the text messages. Parents can see it. And what was once kind of just a, well, he did this to me, and then the other person said, no, I didn't. Well, now it's actually there, and it provides the evidence. And I think seeing things in so much more clarity, I think, has also brought it to our attention and made the internet itself seem like it's the promoter of this, and I think it's really just the recorder of this.
My guest today is David Finkelhor. He's the director of the Crimes Against Children Center and co-director of the Family Research Laboratory at the University of New Hampshire, where he is a professor of sociology. He'll be speaking at OU Tulsa Thursday evening at 6 o'clock on the myth and realities about Internet crimes against children. This takes place at the Schusterman Learning Center at OU Tulsa. Earlier you were talking about, by all of our measures, of how we're measuring Internet usage and the prevalence of these sorts of crimes against children or trying to develop relationships through the Internet with adult offenders and underage teenagers. How good are our measures? Because as you mentioned, this is, even though it seems like the Internet's always been around, it's a new technology, do we have effective measurement at this point?
Not as good as we should, that's for sure. We do have some, and they are getting better. So there's a considerable amount of good news about young people today that hasn't gotten sufficient attention, I'm sorry to say. But since the early 1990s, there have been some actually pretty good measures of problem behavior that have been moving in a very encouraging direction. One of the biggest is juvenile delinquency. Arrests for juvenile crime are down between 60 and 70% for property crime and for violent crime by young people. And it's down more for juveniles than it is even for adults. Risky sexual behavior has also improved. So teen pregnancy, for example, is down by over 50% compared to what it was in the early 1990s. And surveys about young people's sexual behavior, asking them about whether they had three or more sexual partners or whether they've ever engaged in sexual intercourse, both of those measures have shown improvement over this time. Doesn't mean that we don't have serious problems. We still have very high rates of crimes against children. Children are the most vulnerable segment of the population. But on a number of risk measures, and not just crime and sexual abuse, but on things like school violence, on things like school graduation, things like drug usage and alcohol and binge drinking, we've seen improvements. And I think this is very important for people to know, because there's this just tendency to think that things are always getting worse with young people. We have considerable problems that we need to address, but we also need to, I think, take a certain amount of comfort in the successes that we've had. And I think that they also lead us in the direction of knowing what we should do. That there are signs that some of the things we've been doing, like some of the prevention programs that we've been disseminating, some of the treatments that we've brought to bear, the growth in the number of people out there who are helping young people stay safe and develop better coping strategies, that some of that is paying off.
You mentioned crimes against children as being still a serious issue, and this has been one of your main focal points of your work, is getting the word out that crimes against children are occurring and at a pretty high rate from what body of research we have, even though it's sometimes difficult to get that information out there because of the taboo surrounding it. But your research, and from what I've read, suggests that maybe we've been wrongheaded in where we place our focus on prevention, or perhaps not as effective as we could be.
Well, putting attention on young people is definitely a big payoff in terms of preventing crime and violence and a lot of other social problems too. We have an increasing amount of evidence that just suggests that early traumatic experiences, and particularly victimizations and exposure to violence in childhood, those are the seeds that lead to a lot of other problems later on in life, including crime and delinquency, drug and alcohol abuse, mental health problems, and even physical ailments. So getting in early is going to have very big payoffs. And it looks as though a couple of the main areas that we should be directing our attention to are, first of all, parenting, because too many kids are still being abused and neglected by their parents, and that is one of the big traumas that kind of sets off a cascade of risky development. And that involves, you know, teaching parents how to discipline their kids in ways that don't involve violence and rejection, helping them to be affectionate and positive with their kids, manage the difficulties that kids are having without a lot of drama. And then the second area seems to be in promoting positive peer relationships in the classroom, the school environment, and the peer group, because kids who are bullied and victimized by their peers and excluded and psychologically harassed are also kids who are at higher risk for that outcome. And we have a lot of programs today that have been shown to be effective at improving the quality of peer relationships and the ability of kids to cope with each other. And those are very promising as well.
Well, of those two areas, where do we need the most work?
Well, I guess I put my money, you know, if I had to pick one of them, still on the parenting.
This is a problem area because it's getting into the heart of a familial relationship that most people don't appreciate people poking their nose into. It's still,
well, that is true. People have a fairly strong sense of privacy. But I also think that most parents really want to be good parents.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that they aspire to very deeply. And they're often aware of some of their failings and some of the things that they don't know. And I think the key problem is finding places and modalities for helping parents in ways that they don't feel like they're just being judged and coerced, and that are really useful. I think the analogy that I've always liked is the way in which we get help with our computer applications. I install something. I don't know a lot about it. I'm playing around with it, and I'm stuck. It doesn't seem to work. Get on the phone, call up the help desk, and somebody helps me through it. But somehow, the kind of thing that we do to get parents help is we make them go to a meeting in some office, a week after they've had a blow up with their kid. It's somehow just not immediate enough. It's not when they needed it. I have this vision of us being able to provide more real-time help to parents and help them cope when they need it in their homes. And I think we should be able to do that. We have some people who are experimenting with those kinds of interventions, and a sign that they can work.
And the other thing that goes with parenting is if you came from a home where you didn't have really strong parenting to begin with, you may not have the skills to pass that on.
Well, that's true. We live in a world today where you can grow up without having had much experience taking care of other kids, without seeing how other people have parented. And if you have sort of imperfect model of how to parent, that may be the only thing that you know about. So we should be doing more to start very early, with teenagers before they, become parents, to do things about parenting education, parenting skills, and letting them spend time with kids. I think there's a lot more that we can do with boys and men. And I think men are increasingly interested in being around kids, having relationships with kids, but they're often the ones who really haven't given much thought to it and need a few basic skills to know how not to get into trouble, how not to lose their cool and get angry and be abusive. So there's a lot we can do. I think in particular, one of the models that I like is efforts to integrate parent education and parent support right into healthcare and pediatric practices, so that when people go for well-child visits and when they have young children, that they also have someone to talk to about how their parenting is going. They can also get resources that can help them think about what they want to do in anticipation of various kinds of problems that are going to come up, and that we think about that interaction as a place to disseminate all that good information.
Any evidence-based models out there?
Yes, there are. In Baltimore, for example, there's a program called SEEK, which is based out of pediatric practice, that's doing, I think, a pretty good job. I'm hopeful that there's some money that has been made available under the Affordable Care Act that I think is maybe going to translate into making some of these kinds of programs more accessible to families.
Now, your whole work has been involved in kind of a dark place, looking at child victimization, and you've come up with this idea of a sort of a integrated look at various child victimization and maltreatment and family violence you call developmental victimology. What do you mean by developmental victimology?
Well, it's kind of a comprehensive and integrated way of thinking about all the ways in which children get victimized. I was asked about 10 years ago to start teaching a course at my university on juvenile delinquency, and I realized that we had a whole discipline that was devoted to all the various crimes and offenses that kids commit, including property crime, violent crime, sex crime, status offenses like running away. And all of this was called juvenile delinquency. It was a very comprehensive and integrated field. And there wasn't anything comparable that had to do with all the different ways in which kids are victimized. In fact, when you looked at the victim field, it was fragmented up into people who were studying, you know, sexual abuse of children over here and kids getting beat up by their dates over here, and kids getting abducted over here, and kids being exposed to domestic violence over here. And they were all competing with one another in terms of getting money or in terms of getting time, you know, in the prevention agenda.
And when you say money, you're talking about research dollars.
No, research, yeah. Prevention resources, intervention resources, all kinds of money. And it really struck me that these were probably groups of people who were all concerned about the same group of kids, largely speaking, and really ought to be having a kind of common cause, a unified approach to what they were trying to do. And one of the reasons why the juvenile delinquency field may be more successful than the whole juvenile victimization field is because they are integrated and coordinated in that way. So I thought, we needed something to kind of represent that, and that's when I came up with the idea of what I call developmental victimology. It's about all the different ways which kids are victimized, but thought about in terms of the developmental trajectory. So, you know, at an early age, most of the victimization is at the hands of parents and caregivers, and then, you know, it moves into a place where more of their victimization is at the hands of peers and acquaintances. And as they get older, you know, you get exposure to things like gang violence and more rape and dating violence and homicide as kids get older. So it's a useful concept in my view.
Do you feel like prevention experts are sort of adopting this model of thinking of like an integrated approach, or is it still very much you're looking at family domestic abuse here, you're looking at child sexual abuse in another part where people are not really communicating across the spectrum yet?
I'd have to say that the enthusiasm for my idea has been has been slow. It's hard for people to change what they've been doing, and it's a little bit challenging for them, I think. And also, it requires taking on a lot. So, you know, if you've spent your career invested in just studying preventing sexual abuse, the idea, well, maybe I should really learn a lot about teen dating violence, or that I should learn a lot about children exposed to domestic violence. Now, it feels like that's a stretch for you.
So
we'll see. A few of the ideas that I've promoted as part of this developmental victimology have caught on. I'd say one of the main ones has been the concept of what I call polyvictimization. It turns out that there are some kids who have experienced a lot of these different kinds of things. They, you know, were abused by their parents, they were bullied by their peers, they've been attacked by their, you know, their romantic partners, you know, they've had property stolen from them by strangers, they've maybe been victimized online, and they are clearly the kids who really need priority attention here. And there are a painful number of them. We find that about 10% of the kids in any youth cohort have this polyvictimization history, and they're the kids who are most likely to have the mental health problems, the psychiatric symptoms, the delinquency, the drug and alcohol problems. And understanding why kids get caught in this cascading set of victimizations, I think, a very important thing. And that is an idea that has caught on, I'd say, more than some of the other things I've been talking about.
Now, one of the things in your talk, you're going to offer some alternative sets of prevention education messages. Some, as you mentioned earlier, have been very effective. Others have been less so. What would be the number one prevention education strategy you might want to change or tweak today? What would you say that would be?
Well, I think that we still don't fully appreciate the degree to which victimization in childhood is focused and is most frequent at the hands of people the kid knows the best. So that's a very important message.
So we're talking family members, close acquaintances, relatives.
And friends.
Friends, yeah.
Right. Neighbors. Mm-hmm. And the second thing that I think we still need to address is how toxic and damaging peer abuse and peer victimization can be. We have a whole institution, the child protection system, which is trying to help prevent kids from being abused by their family members and caregivers, but we're not as good as addressing the whole peer victimization issue. We kind of turn that over to some extent to school authorities who really are not specialized in that. And there still is, I think, a view out there that, oh, this is just normal kid experiences and, learn to protect yourself and shrug it off.
Bullying is a part of childhood at some point or another.
And it really has serious long-term effects on a lot of kids. And whenever you talk about it, you just get a lot of adults come forward and recount what are really just painful and tragic stories of things that happened to the young that they've never forgotten that left an indelible mark on them. And we really can prevent those and ameliorate the effects of those to a much greater extent than I think we've recognized.
All right. Well, I look forward to your talk Thursday at OU Tulsa. David Finkelhor, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for giving me this chance to talk with you. I've enjoyed it.
Dr. David Finkelhor is a professor of sociology at the University of New Hampshire and the director of the Crimes Against Children Center and co-director of the Family Research Laboratory there. He'll be speaking at OU Tulsa on the myths and realities about Internet crimes against children this Thursday evening at 6 o'clock at the Schusterman Learning Center at OU Tulsa. Lecture is free to the public. Information at 918-660-3496. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.